Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In celebration of Gordon Park's ingenuity, dedication, and power, on February 17, 2019, the National Gallery of Art invited artist and educator Adrian Loving and scholar Vicky Toback, author of Contact High, A Visual History of Hip Hop, to explore the visual influences of Gordon Park's legacy. Park's famous image, A Great Day in Hip Hop, from 1998, itself a tribute to Art Kane's 1958 photograph, A Great Day in Harlem, was the touchstone of this discussion that also included writers Harry Allen and Miles Marshall Lewis, as well as filmmaker Nelson George.
On September 29, 1998, 20 years ago, Gordon Park sat on the block of 126th Street between Madison and Fifth Avenue in Harlem. He was there to take a class photo of hip-hop. Over 200 artists, from Rakim to Fab Five Freddy to Black Moon, would make their way there that day in what is now considered a legendary moment in time. A time when a great photographer who described his camera as a weapon of choice photographed a generation of lyricists who used the mic similarly as a weapon of choice to tell the stories of urban America and gave rise to a music that now defines America's mainstream. Many said Gordon Parks was a reach, that he wouldn't agree to photograph a generation of hip-hop artists. But the editorial team at an upstart hip-hop magazine called XXL thought otherwise. It took some coercing, but it happened. Today, Gordon Parks' A Great Day in Hip-Hop is considered an iconic image, inspired by Art Kane's portrait from the 1950s of jazz artists on the same stoop, on the same location. Today, we've assembled some of the writers and filmmakers who were there that day to talk about the legacy of that photo and how Gordon Park's narrative imagery is still inspiring a new generation of artists, from Kendrick Lamar to Swizz Beatz and beyond.
So let's jump right in. You know, it's been 20 years now. Tell us a little bit about, you know, Miles, I guess this would be for you, and Harry as well, about what was the editorial machine that was at work behind to make this photo happen? I mean, you guys were all so young and starting up as writers, you know?
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, for me personally, I had just started as the deputy editor of XXL probably the week before that photo was taken. So all the orchestrations, you know, that it took to like put it together, like I sort of missed all that. It was just like, okay, you know, you fill out your paperwork for your insurance, and then it's like tomorrow it's Gordon Parks and like, you know, 100 hip hop heads on 126th Street. I missed all of that. I know that there was a lot, you know, of stress. There was even competition from Vibe magazine at the time. At the time, it was like Vibe, The Source, and XXL all at each other's, you know, necks and chasing each other for exclusives and stuff. So I know, you know, Vibe at some point wanted to do the same thing once they found out about the concept, to do it first, you know, and it was a lot of sort of stuff like that. But it all came together and it was fabulous.
Actually, I have some footage from the day before. So that's footage from the day, but there was like a walkthrough at the church and so forth. And Sheena talks on camera at length about Vibe magazine.
Yeah.
And certain people at Vibe magazine who remain nameless,
right,
who she was not too happy with, who she claimed, you know, I don't have an independent verification, but she claims were calling publicists and saying don't participate in the photo shoot. So it was really, there was intense competition.
Sure.
I just like to say, I know a little bit about the beginnings of it at least. Michael Gonzalez's girlfriend at the time was
Leslie
also
Pitts.
Leslie Pitts was also my publicist, and she was really a key person in helping put it together for XXL because she had these relationships as a publicist as well as her connection to other publicists. Mm. Because when you look at the footage and you talk, it weren't that many record executives there. It was mostly individual publicists or record label publicists who really pushed their artists to be there. So Leslie was a key person, and even if the day of, she was there early in the morning, there's footage of her talking to the Nation of Islam, explaining to them why they had to block off that street, because if they didn't, there'd be 600 people in the picture. So and that was a huge part of the organization, was trying to figure out how to keep the various people who didn't want the picture to be on that block. And that was a major undertaking. Things was laminates, I remember,
laminates
that were used, and only certain people had the laminates, but trying to keep hip-hop people away from laminates was a... So logistically, it was really a huge challenge to put that photograph together.
Well, in a day before social media, before email, this was all done, you know, by phone calls, beepers, like people calling each other. I think Daytuan, who was an editor, bought Big L because he had lived a couple
blocks
away.
The only reason Big L is in it is because another editor, Daytuan Thomas, who runs Vibe now, ironically, he called Big L like, do you know about this? Like, get down here, you know, and he ran over.
Yeah.
And there was just a lot. I mean, I think the advantage of not having social media was that if that photographs are being done now, trying to keep people from being around it. As you look around, there weren't that many fans, you know, who were lingering around. It was really industry folks. So it was a pretty... a lot of people showed up at the last minute, you know.
Lauryn Hill, which she wasn't in the photograph.
Yes.
You wouldn't think that Lauryn would be late, but somehow Lauryn Hill was like, she pulled up in a car after the photo had been taken.
Yes.
And I don't even really think she got out or hung out. She missed the photo and she sort of...
She's in the car, and actually Herc took a picture with her. Mm. I think Rowan Marley is driving.
Probably.
And she drove up the block, looked around.
Right.
She was gone.
Right. Yeah, Raskas was also late. He didn't make it in. Mm-hmm. And Raskas.
Right.
And there are, I guess, a few people who showed up late and then lived to really...
Run is not actually in the photograph.
Absolutely.
Run is in the documentary, but by the time he had shown up, they had lost the light and he's not in the official photograph.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the dramas is you see it a bit, but Parks is trying to figure out, hey, I believe that, get me wrong, the initial number was like 100.
Yeah, initially.
And then you had... how many people were actually in the photo?
I mean, I don't remember the actual number. What I do remember is creating, like, the key afterwards.
And 160 something or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there were people unidentified, you know, because there were some people who sort of made it into the shot that weren't actually, you know...
Name
supposed
artists.
To be in the shot.
So I have a question. So since this wasn't something that Gordon Parks... Hip-hop wasn't something that he was really shooting, what was his attitude that day? Like, was he, you know, annoyed? Was he sort of like, let's just do this and get it over with? Or was he really engaged? I mean, what was his vibe?
I mean, Gordon was open, you know, because I interviewed him for the essay that I wrote for the piece, and actually I didn't use his comments. It was going to be a sidebar, and then there wasn't room, etc. But I mean, I sat with him, and we were talking about Richard Wright. We were talking about, like, other things. Like, he was just sort of open to, you know, discussing things, and he was glad to be there, glad enough. You know, he had turned it down initially. And Sheena had to convince him.
A couple of times,
yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. Sheena Lester really had to call him personally and be like, look, you know, you're the only person really who can do this. There's not a point to doing it unless you're going to be the one to do it, you know. And the MCs were, like, really excited to be there because he was shooting it. Like, you can see Mos Def saying, like, you know, it's Gordon Parks. He's excited to see Gordon Parks as he is to see Rakim or Kool Herc, you know.
I mean, Willie D from... Ghetto Boys had his copy of Gordon Parks' photo book and had him autograph it. Mm. And there were a number of people who, actually more than him, there were several who had their own photo books of Gordon who were there. Mm-hmm. And I think the turnout, it was as good as it was because it was him. I think that he validated it in a way that if it had just been a younger guy, wouldn't have had the same resonance.
Right.
Mm. He struck me as very professional, I guess is the word that would come to mind. Like, he was very purposeful about what he was doing. He was really concerned about the light. Yeah.
Right.
The light was rapidly going to other parts of the world. And but he was really on what he was doing and not friendly, not unfriendly,
right,
and not distant, just really working on getting the shot.
Mm-hmm. What time did it actually...
2:38, I believe.
Right.
2:38, 2:36.
So there was a whole thing about, they got everyone into the church, which was the organization point. You see people in steps. The problem was everyone had such a good time in the church.
Right.
And people were, it was a giant, right. It was the biggest giant networking party ever. and it was food. And so getting people out of the church, down the steps, down the block, to that was what really took up the time.
Yeah, I'm looking for the
Okay. And so by the time they got there, the light was probably over here on the front row. Yeah. And so it was definitely a ticking clock going on that photograph.
Yeah, and you can see it, you know, it's just moments remaining they would have lost that whole front row.
Yeah. And so losing run, you know, but you know, it was really fun though. I mean, that run thing, that's a total spontaneous reaction. Mm. People, you know, it was a beautiful, my general memory was of the biggest black male bonding event I'd ever been to.
Yeah, it really, and I think I commented on this in the Million, in my essay, that it really reminded me of the Million Men March in a way.
Yeah.
Like,
Questlove had told me the same thing that day.
Yeah, I remember when I went to that event, I remember first I wasn't gonna go, and then I decided to go, and what surprised me, and what I'd never experienced, was just this overwhelming sense of peace and calm. It was almost like a substance. And just walking among all of these black men who were just all just glad to be there and around each other, you know, in peace. And there was really a sense of that there as well, I think. And like you said, network, you showed this in the documentary, but what you saw a lot of was people exchanging numbers. There's a lot of people exchanging numbers, people amazed that they were there, amazed at other people. I mean, these are artists, but they're first of all fans, and fans of all of these other people that they are artists with. Yeah. And so that sense of camaraderie, and also a good point was made about the so-called East Coast, West Coast beef, which had been just utterly badly diagnosed in media and blown up to make stories. There was a certain amount of, I think, in the culture, a certain amount of loss and sadness over these recent events, the deaths of Tupac and Biggie, these giants. And then to have all of these people from all parts of the country, certainly, come together and just love each other. You just really felt the love everybody had that they were part of this great experiment called hip-hop. That was what I most remember, and I think that was just the overwhelming sense. Probably, I'm sure you guys would agree that.
Yeah, I would say, just in terms of the black community, we have our black colleges have homecomings where, you know, alumni come back and meet and we go to the football game and hang out and stuff like that, fraternities, sororities, you know, reconvene, and family reunions, you know, like in the summertime when it's hot, you go down south from where your parents were originally from and you go see your cousins and there's a big cookout and stuff like that. Like, it had that flavor to it, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we started the initial shot. I don't know if people, we don't have captions on this yet. So MC Shan, how many people knew that was MC Shan at the beginning? Okay, so MC Shan is one of the original Queens MCs. He's from Queensbridge.
Where Nas is from.
The Bridge Is Over. It's one of his most famous records. Yeah. So when Corrupt walks up from the East Coast, now he's part of,
Dog Pound Gangster. DPG.
So we really wanted to open with that
Snoop.
Because they had never met. They had never met, but they were kindred spirits in hip-hop. And so there's a moment where they come together, and Shan, you can see, is legitimately shocked and even embarrassed.
Right.
You know, that he got, and so that kind of communication, that was happening all over the place. Mm. And that all those little posses and ciphers you see are all people meeting each other for the first time in many cases, and like, I love your work. Oh, we're gonna need to work together. That was networking, but also a love fest. And then when Cam'ron walks up, who's from Harlem, so you have Queens, Harlem, Compton, and I'm not sure even Cam'ron knew Corrupt at that time. I'm not sure.
Probably not.
So that sense of camaraderie, and I think it comes through in the photograph. Everyone says we're warring nations, but in essence, we're all connected. And without you, I don't exist. Right. And that was I felt that thread.
I think there's a thing that happens in moments like that, where when you meet peers and people who are applying the same craft that you're doing, you get a sense that this is bigger than me. This is really bigger than I am. And I think that is something that a lot of people, when you see the eloquent, most deaf reduced to just like, what is this? Like, I mean, I think that's part of what he was feeling. Like, this is just I'm not just a fan, like I'm a peer of these people as well. And this is, there's all this greatness around me. Like, what is this all about?
Like, I'm part of this continuum.
It's like, yes. It's like I'm here, but it's also a mystery at the same time. Like, what does this all mean? What does this, all this greatness and ability and talent mean to have it all here in one place? And we try to represent that with the photograph.
Well, I think speaking of continuum, that's an important word. I think one of the things that we're trying to do today with celebrating Gordon Parks is to look at his influence beyond hip-hop and looking at it into contemporary culture and his work through fashion, his work through his visual sense through new music videos. So we're going to show you some things that we feel are representative of some of his influence and sort of unpack some of these things. One of them is Kendrick Lamar's Element, where if you've seen the video, I'm sure probably most of you have, there's some, you know, shot by shot, were inspired by Gordon Parks. I really started to think about Gordon Parks's photography narratives showing up in like newer film. I mean, if you look at, you know, considering the age of the sort of renaissance of black film that we're in with like Moonlight and all these other films that are coming out, and how black skin is being represented and shown and shot, and how sort of photographic stills become these baselines for stories, you know, you can look at Gordon Parks under a new lens. And so I think this is some of the things that we're trying to unpack. I mean, you saw some of these photographs within the video that are played out, especially the Muslim woman, which is one of his more famous photographs.
Also the Red Jackson stuff in the exhibit down the hall. Hope everyone here goes visit. There's a whole set of photographs of a guy named Red Jackson who was a 17-year-old Harlem gangster. And I think it's, I forgot what year, 43 or something like that, after the war. And there's so many echoes in this imagery of the Red Jackson photographs. There's a shot of him and his friend looking at a dead body, a friend who was shot. And there's a shot with a little kid with the bullet hole in the mirror. Mm-hmm. There's a really iconic shot of Red Jackson at a window looking out a broken glass window. Apparently he's being circled by a rival gang and he's looking out to see what his next move is. So there's a lot of texture of also there's a lot of high contrast in the Parks' work. The blacks are literally very, very dark. And I see a lot of echoes of that in some of the lighting. And even, I hadn't even thought about that till you mentioned it, but Moonlight. Yeah. Moonlight has a lot of echoes of Parks' portrait work in it. So it's interesting. That was one that I hadn't rang a bell until you said that, but Barry Jenkins actually takes a lot from Parks, or at least maybe secondary influence.
I mean, what strikes me a bit is that Stanley Kubrick was a photographer initially who transitioned into becoming a director, as Gordon Parks did. You know, when you have an eye that strong, you know, it needs to sort of transition into something else, let's say, you know, because Gordon did Shaft, right? And his son did Superfly. And Shaft is, they're making like a third sequel to Shaft. Yeah. Like this summer is like the story that won't end, you know? But yeah, Gordon, you know, his eye was phenomenal. It's like he directed The Learning Tree, yes, yeah. Which was an adaptation of the memoir, I guess, that he wrote about his life or something. So, you know, it's just no surprise that he would become a filmmaker ultimately, because his shots are so, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, I would just walk through the exhibit, how cinematic his framing is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he has a lot of action. He did a lot of work with steel workers and coal miners, which I hadn't really seen before, and the framing and the capture of movement. I have one Gordon Parks anecdote. I was around when they were friends of mine. Some of the guys who worked on this doc worked on the doctors on HBO about Gordon. Mm. And so there's this anecdote they had about, they were with him, and one guy had a Polaroid camera. And he saw something, can I borrow your Polaroid? Now this guy has a Polaroid, it's a Polaroid, you know, it's back then. Gordon took the picture. He didn't get the picture developed for a couple of months. It's a Polaroid, right? It takes time, you take it to the shop, it comes back. He said the framing was unbelievable. He said this was a goddamn Polaroid Instamatic. And it was as beautiful as anything he'd seen, and he couldn't do that with, so that his eye was kind of unbelievable in terms of he could see something and see exactly where to put the camera and find the right moment, which is just insane.
Well, his talent, I mean, he'd been shooting since he was a kid. And one thing that's interesting about The New Tide, the show that's up now, and it's over tomorrow, I believe. If you haven't seen it, definitely see it.
You must, yeah.
It really goes back to his early pictures. So you talk about his work shooting coal miners and in more sort of landscapes and industrial scenes. And it starts, parts of it start to go into a little bit of his fashion work. But he was so diverse in his visual and what he was able to sort of travel and see and frame, and everything that he shot was amazing. Yeah. You know,
it the contrast of work. I saw images in it. I've read work of Alan Locke. You know, the new Negro. I'd never seen Alan Locke. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what he looked like. Mm-hmm. Horace Caton, who did the Black Metropolis, a famous book in the 40s about Black Chicago. I'd never seen him. Mm-hmm. So he had work where he documented important Black history. At the same time, he went up to Canada. And shot guys who were working in coal mines. And I mean, the range of his sympathetic eye, everyone's captured in a very relaxed moment, whether it's a model from Paris or a gangster from Harlem or, you know, the most unlikely Canadian miner. And so that empathy, I think the other thing that someone like who's that good has to be that empathetic. And it's funny, like talking about that day at the where he shot this. He was I think he was kind of surprised. I remember this footage of him at the end where people are coming up to him because everyone crowded around him at the end. Right. I mean, it was literally a receiving line, and I think he looked kind of shocked because I don't know how much contact he'd had with that younger generation of Black Americans at that point in his life. He lived at he lived at UN Plaza. I went to his house one time for. I was something, I forgot. I got lucky, I got to go up in there. And he has a collection, one of his last photography books is this still lifes that look like moonscapes. Mm-hmm. So it turned out the moonscape was he had like a terrarium in his house. It's not that big. And he had shot almost all the still lifes in that terrarium. And like just knowing where to put the camera to make it look immense.
That's deep.
So, So he was one of the most, I mean, I've met a lot of artists, but I think he's one of the most inherently gifted people I've ever met. And he also, by the way, composed music. Right. He did the score for the second Shaft movie he directed.
That's true, that's true.
He's a fine writer. You know, The Learning Tree is one of his books, but that was one of about five or six books. Mm-hmm. Choice of Weapons was another book that I read of his. So he wrote books, he directed major feature films,
he composed, but if I'm not mistaken, he sang also. Isn't there like a Gordon Parks album?
I think there is.
I believe that, you know, if you go
there
to YouTube,
album, yeah.
There's like he's, you know, the styles of Gordon Parks.
Well,
he's
what's
like,
interesting though, you know? I think considering placing him in a particular time period of the 40s, moving into the 50s, I mean, he's sort of coming in, you know, as the sort of Harlem Renaissance, and those artists have sort of had their main time, but still being influenced by what the work that they did. But then that sort of period going into like shaping Black Americana. Like if you look at this image right here, which I think is really important, it's so transcendent to what finds its way into the video. So, you know, he had a read on things that were happening or could happen or were going to happen. And he was able to sort of really go into these sort of small rural towns and find those seminal moments, and he was also able to go into the urban cities and get those seminal moments. I think that's what his range, part of his range of it.
Well, I'm just gonna give you a total geek out moment, geeky moment now. See the turtleneck I'm wearing? This turtleneck is very much like the turtleneck that Richard Roundtree wears in Shaft. And that's on purpose. Because my family and I, Shaft, what Black Panther was, for this generation,
right.
Shaft was for us.
Right.
Okay, my entire floor in the projects, we all and our mothers got in the subway from way in Brownsville, way in the hood, to 42nd Street, which we called the 40 Deuce. Right. We took the Iron Horse, which was the subway, and there was a giant cutout on the Criterion Theater of Shaft, you know, in the black leather outfit and the whole thing. And we all went and we stood online. And seeing Richard Roundtree come out of the subway station, the same subway station that I used to come out of, with the wah-wah pedals going, and the leather jacket, and the turtle, I was like, yes. So The reason they bring Shaft back, I hope it looked like they're making a comedy of it, unfortunately, but yeah, Shaft was that, you know, Sidney Poitier had been there and he'd been a certain kind of masculinity, but that kind of cosmopolitan masculinity, a kind of suaveness, that just hadn't been on screen.
Right. And like blacks weren't allowed to be James Bond.
Exactly. Right. And so that was, I think, for a whole generation of and continuing on, even I see Drake in his turtleneck and his little, I think, Drake is, you know, because there's something about the turtleneck and the blazer, which is a certain kind of signifier of cool.
Right?
And Steve McQueen and Richard Roundtree are sort of the definers of that for me. So and he, I always think the Shaft is a projection of Gordon. Because
that's
Gordon,
interesting.
Because he Shaft can move in the village. Shaft can move uptown. Shaft, he was a cosmopolitan figure. He can move to all these different environments in New York. And that was Gordon.
You might say he's all city, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this photograph I picked out because I thought it was quite interesting. Who's seen Do the Right Thing? Everybody, right? Okay, good. So sort of moving through...
Mother, sister.
Moving through the influence of that moment sitting in the window. If you've lived in a neighborhood where there's somebody watching out for you, everybody's, you know, watching the all-seeing mother, sister, or the aunt, or someone who's perched, you know, watching over you to make sure nothing goes down. I mean, this is that black story. This is that, it's well, I mean, it's beyond black stories.
There's
but
even a little frame in your film, sort of like yes. this, of someone in the window.
In the mirror, and
then with the cat.
With the cat.
Yeah.
And looking back through the footage, you can see people in the buildings when they were shooting it, and actually there's some children. Some of the children who were in the, there's a photo that I think Jonathan Rheingold took with Gordon and a bunch of kids. I think those kids lived in the building, so in some of the footage, you can actually see them peeking out at all these rappers. And like, oh, wow, I wish I could go back out. that connectivity.
No, Michael Gonzalez, who couldn't be here today, I was on my way to see him in Brooklyn sometime last year. And while he was, I think, house-sitting for Amy Linden, another writer that we know. And so on my way there, I saw a woman in Brooklyn sitting in the window, and I, like, you know, pulled my phone out and, like, took a shot of it, you know, just because of that kind of, you know, thing that Gordon would do, like, all the time. I took my kids to Euro Disney at some point, and there was a little white girl, she could have been 6 or 7, with the Mickey Mouse ears and, like, a huge shotgun from Frontierland or something in her arm. And I was like, wow, like, that says so much about America. Like, I would take a picture of her, but I would have to ask her mom first, and I don't want to, you know, just take a picture of a random kid. But, like, Gordon Parks went through that all the time. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was just his normal eye to be able to catch moments continuously. Like, you know, that's just how he lived.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sort of going back to Do the Right Thing, I mean, this film's 30 years old this year, you know, so it's interesting to connect the dots between, you know, time, you know, what was presented in the film in terms of a story and what's happening now, and then looking back to sort of certain scenes in that film and then connecting them back to Parks. Like, there is a connect the dots moment, at least for me.
Well, he's an incredibly influential image maker. And one really key reason he is that he is one of the first American photographers to show black people as subjects as opposed to as objects. And when you're getting Life magazine in the mail every week and you're seeing black people not as property or as the disdained, but instead as barbers, as neighbors, as children looking for ice cream, and this isn't a time before television. So we're talking about the power of these images at that time to really discuss and show and represent the breadth of life that black people experience, but that for the most part stays off the image bearing devices of whatever era. However black people are represented in any medium at any time, our lives are so much wider. But what usually gets through is just what's coming out of a straw, so to speak. And Gordon Parks was showing black people as we were, and this was disruptive. This was not the norm, and it was, I mean, when I look at his work, and then also when I see that he's speaking of his camera as a choice of weapons. When I decided I wanted to start writing, I called myself hip hop activist and media assassin. And I said, I want my work as a writer to be lethal. I want it to be pointed and targeted and precise. I want my work to have that kind of assassinating effect. I want people to get hit and not know what hit them. And he said, I want my camera to be a weapon. I really connect to that. I really connect to the idea that black life is so important that you have to kind of run guard. You have to have your weapon unholstered just to make sure that stuff gets through. You can't just count on it, you know, being handled well by the mail, you know.
Miles, you working with Ebony, a lot of Gordon Parks' photographs came through. What was your experience with Gordon's work?
Yeah, I mean, nothing specific at Ebony, actually. You know, I did work at Ebony from maybe 2013 to 2016 or so, you know. In the office, there were two offices, one in Chicago, one in New York. The New York was mainly the digital office. But either way, in the New York office, there were archives that I would go through when, you know, on downtime, lunch, you know, and I would like just go through the old issues and be amazed by, you know, some of the articles and stuff. And so naturally, I thumbed through some of Gordon's stuff, you know. But it's just an amazing archive of, you know, the African-American experience. And just Ebony in itself is like sort of a curator of the African-American experience, let's say, you know, our history in this country. And Gordon Parks was a big part of that.
So you can see the sort of shaft again. And Gordon, Shaft's big score, great soundtrack. That very well, we don't have the RZA album cover, but RZA sort of took some from that, the sort of Shaft's big score, even the typography as well.
But these are truly, I mean, this is revolutionary stuff. As late as 1992 when Juice came out,
and I believe,
and they had the image of Tupac Shakur, and yeah, they wouldn't show the gun in his hand. Mm-hmm. The posters were made without the gun being seen, and then you have the Ice-T film with Ice Cube that was originally called Looters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then they turned it to, what was it called again after?
Yeah, what did
right.
they turn
it?
They changed it to. So these images of black men with guns, shooting guns, posing with guns, holding guns as phallic objects. Right. I mean, like, this was an era. This is really like a breakthrough.
This is a couple of years after the Panthers. So, I mean, what right. clearly...
Contemporaneous with them, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this was definitely the Hollywood... What Shaft
But just
did,
a few years after Sidney Poitier.
Yeah.
I mean, not after, but like Lilies of the Field and things of that nature.
Right,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's for those of you who are too young... There was a real psychological break between Poitier and the blaxploitation era. Poitier wore white shirts with ties and suits in almost every film. And he sort of represented upwardly mobile, acceptable black male behavior. And, you know, which was still kind of revolutionary.
Absolutely.
At the time. When the black nationalist thing happened and the Panther thing happened, immediately a lot of the figures from that era, we were talking about that earlier, who are the uplift civil rights era people from the 60s, suddenly seem corny, and at worst, Uncle Tom. And then, you know, Van Peebles with Sweetback, and then Shaft, and then Superfly and all these movies, they unleashed the id of black America, the bad nigga id, that had been kept out of the movies. And so these songs, and then the soundtracks along with them, you know, the fact that just, I did, this cat Shaft's a bad mother, shut your mouth. Yeah. The idea that he almost said motherfucker was considered really revolutionary. Now, in the hip-hop era, you know, that's light stuff. But at the time, these kind of movements of total black aggressiveness, and then we throw in Foxy Brown and Cleopatra Jones as well, these were for the average, maybe we weren't the most political, and everyone was political at that time, contrary to what was
These going. Were our superheroes.
But these were really, really important for our generation to see this idea of of agency.
Right.
And a lot of those, you know, a lot of the stories revolved around either the mafia controlling the hood and black gangsters taking over. And almost every movie there's a thread, and this one there's a big thread of black revolutionaries working with Shaft to kick the white evil criminals out of the hood, or out of Harlem, whatever. And that was a running thread. So these ideas about empowerment were very powerful. And it wasn't until hip-hop came back, then there was a period when that all went down, that hip-hop brought back a lot of that imagery. So there's a direct connection through Shaft and the other blaxploitation to hip-hop. Absolutely. I mean, so many of the samples that became the canon of hip-hop come out of these records made roughly 68 to 74. And a lot of them were blaxploitation soundtracks.
I guess it's almost like Shaft is the imagery that Gordon Parks could not have put in Life magazine.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I said the thing about Shaft, that he really was some projection of Gordon's cosmopolitan nature. Mm. And I think that's one of the things, even though we talk about Gordon in a black context, Gordon shot everything. When you look at his body of work, I was shocked at some of the shots of the white working men are super powerful. So it wasn't like he was an artist. He was a black artist who could shoot anything and shoot it beautifully.
Well, his contemporaries, you know, you had Gary Winogran, you had Richard Avedon, you had Anthony Barboza. I mean, you had all these people who were shooting amazing work, and including black imagery. So I'm sure there was some competition. He probably felt like, let me get the best. But he seemed like he sort of stayed in his lane, but he could do well with anything, you know.
And just a fun fact, Harry, you brought up the film Juice, and Adra Cowens. Was a colleague, also, you know, Gordon mentored a lot, was the set photographer on Juice, and that shoot is actually in the book.
Did he take the picture of the poster?
No, not the poster, but all the behind the scenes. Adric Cowan's another great.
The set photography.
Yeah.
Right. Can I make one more point about Gordon in the context of now? Is it because Gordon was such a multifaceted artist? There was a time when, you know, you were a writer or you were a director or you were a thing. And Gordon and I, my two favorite artists are Van Peebles and Gordon for that reason. Mm-hmm. They were these multidimensional guys who did all kinds of stuff. And at the time it was considered pretty radical. You didn't really go outside of your discipline. And I mean, when I think about my career, I think about Gordon and Van Peebles as my mentors because they were people who started in one thing or another and then ended up doing a bunch of other things out of that. They had a core experience. But so I remember meeting Van Peebles and Gordon when I was in my 20s and just being knocked out by, you did what in the Paris in 19, you were there? And these are also guys who traveled a lot. And I think that helped them feel, when they went, they both spent a lot of time in Paris.
Yeah.
When their formative years. And I think that traveling and that sense of a possibility that they got from that European experience definitely helped them feel not as restricted by the restrictions here in America.
Vicky, did you want to say something about the pimp culture thing?
Well,
I think you sort of, we put this in,
sure.
You wanted to say something, so.
I'll chime in. this was just a continuation of what we're talking about, you know, borrowing the imagery, from Shaft into, you know, contemporary personas, but also, you know, just continuing on what you guys are saying, you know, with the idea of masculinity and power, you know, we put these here. This is Sugar Free and Snoop, you know, both of which sort of play with that trope of pimp culture as power.
And Gordon shot this Superfly. Didn't you shoot this Superfly cover?
His son.
Okay.
Can I build on something that Nelson just said?
Sure, yeah, sure.
I think, you know, something that's really important, I think, is to use the past and to use the examples of great people from the past to inspire one's own life choices and to see what they did as instructional. So you said that I spoke with Van Peebles and Gordon Parks, and it gave me kind of an instruction on how I might construct my own career. You know, that they traveled, they tried different kinds of things, they didn't stay in one box, they worked for a long time, you know, and they stayed connected with the generations that came after them. So you wouldn't imagine the Gordon Parks who shot the Shell Oil pictures with direct Shaft necessarily, not to mention, you know, photograph, you know, one of the most famous photos of hip hop artists, but he was still working and still staying connected. And I think there's a lot in looking at the great people of history and how they lived their lives and how they made their choices and taking instruction from them and looking to those lives, sometimes as templates, sometimes as warnings, you know, on how to live one's... How many people in here are artists? Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. I'm sure many of you look to the people of the past who were creative, for instruction, for guidance, if not, and certainly for examples as well as in terms of creativity. And I think that's a really important point.
No,
that he's not just a person who did these things, but he's living for us who choose to say, I should try that. I can do that.
Right. No, this is the conversation that we had. I had mentioned it earlier, where we talked about Richard Wright. You know, because this was, I guess, 1998 when the photo was taken. And the one thing that I said to him really after we talked about the photograph and the setup and stuff was like, being an expat. Like, you know, we talked about Richard Wright and he knew him, of course. They were contemporaries, kind of. And like, you know, he was just like, I was asking him, like, so why didn't you go? You know, like, Richard Wright left to Paris. You know, James Baldwin did the same thing. Like, it seemed like people were sort of...
Why didn't you go there and stay for years?
You know? And he said, well, you know, this is my home, you know? Simply, you know, like, why leave? Or, you know, like, the problems that this country has, I need to stay here and help deal with them and stuff like that, you know? But, I mean, I personally went over, you know this, but I went to Paris. I lived in Paris from 2004 to whenever, 11 years later or 7 years later. I stayed there for 7 years. My kids were born there as well. My wife, originally from Martinique, you know, I met in Paris. And so I had that experience primarily because of the instruction of Baldwin in particular.
And what did you learn from being there? I mean, probably a lot of things, but was there any one thing that comes to mind?
The one thing that comes to mind is that they have racism.
Yeah, exactly.
For some reason, I
thought
they...
Don't get it twisted.
Right? For some reason, initially when I got there, I figured it was just this utopia.
Welcome, brother.
This utopia, you know. But what it is that as a Black American, they see you as an American. And so your experience there as a Black American is not going to be the experience that an African...
Climbing up a wall and...
Who came from... Right, exactly. You know, like an African from Nigeria or Algeria, you know, would have in Paris. Your experience won't be the same, even though you both have the same skin, because they see you as an American and, you know, I don't know, it's a different thing. Mm. But the racism is still there. It's just for a different... segment
different
of the population.
Yeah. Well, that was a perfect segue into Richard Wright. Vicky and I had a conversation about Richard Wright and Invisible Man, and sort of looking at that as an idea.
What do you mean,
Ralph Ellison?
I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, Ralph Ellison. My fault. Just about the idea of Invisible Man, and looking at a video that sort of... being invisible in a space or in a culture, you exist, but you're invisible in it. And so I wanted to show you this Flying Lotus clip and kind of go into a little discussion. But did you want to say something about...
No, I was just going to say, directed by Khalil Joseph, and this, you know, this idea, not just being separated or surreal, you know, having this surreal disconnect from reality, but also the idea of interior life. You know, Harry, to your point earlier, that, you know, what is portrayed versus this vastness of what else is interior. And I think Gordon's photographs really touched upon that idea of this interior life of people. So, yeah, so we pulled, and, you know, I think there's a lot of filmmakers working today, a lot of cinematographers working today that really want to get to that thing that Gordon tapped into. So this is a video, just a clip of a video that Khalil Joseph directed for Flying Lotus.
You want to talk a little bit about what you...
Yeah, I mean, just going back to, you know, this idea of, you know, a person feeling disconnected, feeling, you know, like their skin color doesn't tell the full story of who they are as a man, as a person. So, you know, coming out of that and looking here, you know, Underground Man, and also this photo, you know, that Gordon had, the Ralph Ellison, you know, story of a man who sort of creates his own life underground, you know. I guess, Harry, if you could talk more about this idea of interior life, as seen in these photographs and now, you know, in all these contemporary works that we're seeing. Is that something that is new, is being pushed boundaries on by contemporary directors?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
So, you know, I think this idea of one's interior life or your the vastness, like you were saying earlier, are we really digging into that in contemporary culture? People who are making these films and music, is that something that you feel like you're seeing more of, Gordon's influence on that aspect?
I think so. I think certainly in terms of the representation of African American and other people of color, but certainly African American people in film and in other media. I think hip hop has a lot to do with this. I feel a kind of almost like a race, kind of like to like let it all hang out. You take a show like Black-ish, for example, you really feel like the showrunner and the actors and the writers are really working to kind of like make all the details of Black life pictorial and to kind of make them fit in a mode of storytelling that kind of takes apart the logic of what it means to be Black. And I think Black image makers more and more feel they have the license, even the responsibility, to find those little stories, those nuances, those little hooks, those things that only Black people know when they see them or hear them. You know, there's a reason when Ice Cube said "Bye, Felicia," that line traveled decades and has never gone away. That's not a throwaway line. And so I think like all those little things that have to do with the way we relate to each other, how we see the world, our logic, our objectives, our fears. I think more and more like the goal is to get those things in front, that's real. And when it's real, people feel it. And when it's real, everyone feels it. You know, the goal in making your art is to not be general, it's to be specific. The more specific you are, the more people resonate and feel it. And a lot of people don't see how that would work, but the more specific you are, the truer you are. And the truer you are, the more someone is going to be attacked by that. Mm-hmm. Is going to be hit by your truth. Mm-hmm. If I've answered your question,
I would just say I would take issue a little bit with the idea that hip hop has been that good a force for doing that.
Okay. Let's go.
Yeah. Battle.
Let's go.
No. I would just say that at least a lot of what's considered mainstream hit making hip hop since the era of Public Enemy. Mm. Has been very consumed with consumerism, and consumerism.
Okay, so let me interject.
Wow, yeah,
so,
please.
So take a show like Atlanta.
No, I'm not talking about the shows. I'm talking about actual music. The shows are a different thing.
Okay, I thought we were talking about just representations of blackness.
No,
okay. Because Atlanta is run
by
Childish Gambino, who's a rapper.
I'm talking about the records.
Yeah, okay.
I'm talking about trap music. I'm talking about Cardi B.
I don't think rabid consumerism is divorced from the aspirations of Black people at all.
No, but I'm saying is that it's the number one, it's become the stereotype that hip hop falls upon and uses as its prop.
Because it works.
But that doesn't mean it's...
Because it's not separated from the aspirations of Black people at all.
But it does also play into your... It seems to be a negation of your point, which is that we're looking for these nuances, and consumerism is not nuanced.
So, it's kind of like if you build a rocket, it needs to be a certain size for it to lift off, but if you just keep adding more rocket, eventually it'll be so heavy it won't lift off at all. So in a similar sense, it's like, yeah, everyone's trying to do the consumerism thing because it worked for the last guy, and then that's where you have a cancer, just rabid growth.
Well, that's my point, Harry.
Yeah. If your point is that there's too much of it,
yes.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
So every time an artist comes out who doesn't do that, we're like, wow, that's the real Black experience.
Let's give him a Pulitzer.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
So I'm just...
But it's not disconnected from Black aspirations.
No, but
none of that
but,
stuff
but,
is.
What I'm saying is that there's a difference between Black aspiration and nuance of Black life, and I'm just going to do what the other guy did to get on.
That's commercialism.
Yes.
Right.
So I
that's
think
commercialism.
That to me, that's what Atlanta does it in a very nuanced way.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think so.
Whereas, you know, I don't think Domingos do it in a nuanced way. So that would be my point.
Wow, this is getting good. We're going to go through a couple more things,
getting
and
good?
Then we're going to have a Q&A because we certainly want your opinions.
Oh,
you
yes.
guys enjoying the talk so far? Great, great. A few more minutes, and then we're going to get into some of your thoughts. These are some more images. You picked Jamel Shabazz, Vicky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to go through, you know, contemporary photographers that were clearly influenced by this take your camera into the community and really capture, you know, the essence. I mean, Jamel Shabazz, who was honored actually by the Gordon Parks Foundation last year.
Wow.
And his amazing, amazing capture of everyday life, you know, mostly in the 70s, 80s, but definitely into today as well. So, and also just the way, you know, the way Jamel interacts with his subjects, you know, he tells people before he takes their portrait, he says, excuse me, you know, I see greatness in you. May I take your photo? And saying that to someone, you know, who isn't used to having their photo taken every day, it brings out this greatness, which I think you...
Or who isn't used to being told that they're great.
Right.
And I just wanted to sort of highlight Gordon Parks' amazing fashion work, which I never really got to see that much of because a lot of it came out long before I was looking at magazines. But just to sort of reemphasize his brilliance in this medium as well, too. I mean, this is Iman. I mean, and the stuff he was shooting in the 60s next to the Avedons and all those other artists. And publishing in Harper's Bazaar, I think. And Vogue, excuse me.
Well, and when you think about, of course, that we had this seminal moment last year when Vogue actually had its first ever cover photographed by an African-American, which is crazy. I mean, you think about, you know, Gordon doing all that work, but it wasn't until last year that Beyonce selected Tyler Mitchell to do her portrait for the cover of Vogue. So a lot of firsts that are actually quite recent that, you know, stem from the work that Gordon was doing.
Rolling Stone magazine as well, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right, Dana
first
Scruggs.
Black photographer yes. do the cover yes. just months ago.
Yes.
Oh, what was the subject?
Good question, I don't remember.
And, you know, and then just artists, you know, Swizz Beatz and Alicia, they hold, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest, collections of Gordon Parks' work in their personal collection.
Right.
They actually asked Jamel Shabazz to, you know, photograph them for this cover in the style, you know, based on a photo that had been taken by Gordon Parks. So just contemporary, you know, collectors yeah. and artists.
I had attended the Gordon Parks Gala maybe 5 years ago. They have an annual one. And that particular night, Swizz and Alicia were there, and they bought the double XL photo.
Yeah. So fun fact, I just want to pause. Actually, this isn't super widely known yet, but I'll share with you guys today that this year, the Gordon Parks Foundation annual gala, which is in June, which is also going to be hosted by Swizz Beatz and Alicia Keys, the Gordon Parks Foundation decided to honor the Great Dane Hip Hop photo this year.
That's so great.
Yeah, it's going to be incredible. Yeah, so...
I think we're going to have to wrap up here, but I want to say thank you to our amazing panel of guests.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.